In the month of May, we're dealing with themes of embodiment. And this is Memorial Day weekend also. So I offer you a story about a Unitarian family that I think exemplifies spiritual embodiment and also was mortally touched by that greatest American bloodbath, the Civil War. To begin with, Francis, Frank to his friends, was born in 1808 to a wealthy Unitarian family in Boston. His father, Robert, was the leading merchant prince of New England at that time. As eldest son, Frank entered the company business in his late teens, and his fellow workers and his father soon agreed that Robert had great promise and would one day certainly replace his father at the head of the company. They were to be disappointed. Frank's heart was going in a different direction. His Lily and the Paper Man moment came as a result of travel. His father sent him on a trip to all the major ports where the company traded, so he traveled from Boston to New York to Philadelphia, down to the South, and ultimately ended up in the Caribbean at Havana. He was a careful observer, and what he saw in these places was widespread poverty, suffering, and human loss. And he sized up his trading contacts as greed-driven men with little in the way of moral principles. He asked himself why the few had prosperity and almost all the rest were, in his words, sunk. This outlook stayed with him for a lifetime. And he began to study the French socialists. He spoke French, especially Charles Fourier, who advocated cooperative rather than competitive social organization. At that same time, he was drawing away from the mainstream of his fellow Unitarians. He'd come to regard them as too much concerned with amassing wealth, and theologically, too dependent on Christian scripture and on the stories of the miracles of Jesus. Of course, he was hanging out with the radicals, the transcendentalists. Whenever he could catch a sermon by Ralph Waldo Emerson, he did. He befriended the even more radical ministers George Ripley and Theodore Parker. But taken all together, his thoughts were way out of the mainstream for New England in those days, and there were very few people he could discuss them with, candidly. But one of those was his half-cousin, Sarah. They grew up from children together, and as they became young adults, they grew closer and closer, and of course they fell in love. And in June of 1835, Francis George Shaw, that was his full name, and Sarah Blake Sturgis were married. Soon after that, Frank quit his company, his father's company, and moved out to the country. Well, 9 miles out from Boston to West Roxbury. If you went there today, you wouldn't think it was out in the country. But it happened to be where the local Unitarian minister was, Theodore Parker. Moving to the country was popular among the transcendentalists. In Roxbury, Frank and Sarah moved from radical thinking to activism. And at the same time, they raised what turned out to be a remarkable family. Frank had been imbued with feminism as well as socialism in his study of Fourier. He reflected it in his family arrangements. He supported Sarah in her activities outside the domestic sphere and encouraged his daughters to choose their own paths, whether they led to marriage or to roles that challenged contemporary gender boundaries. Frank and Sarah had 5 children, 4 girls and 1 boy. They schooled those children in their personal value system that demanded selfless service to the community. All 4 daughters remained active in reform work and public service even long after their marriages. Josephine, widowed in the Civil War, devoted herself thereafter to scientific charity, so-called in those days, within the New York State welfare system. She became the first woman ever appointed to state office in the state of New York. The son, Robert, called Rob, seemed to be the least assertive of the children. He dropped out of Harvard, although he did like the social life. He tried business for a while, didn't like that much, and frankly, he was kind of lukewarm towards his parents' high ideals. But as we shall see, he became the most famous of them all. The greatest social issue of the time was, of course, slavery. Right after they were married, Sarah and Frank joined with fellow Unitarians William Lloyd Garrison and the other one, Lydia Marie Child, as part of the American Anti-Slavery Society. It's fair to say that they were a despised minority in the early 1840s. They were radical abolitionists, that is to say, they favored freeing all the slaves immediately, as opposed to, say, Abraham Lincoln, who was nominally against slavery, but he never considered direct emancipation until he was forced to it in the war. He believed that slavery was a dying institution and that the main thing was to keep it contained where it was. The Garrisonians didn't buy any of that. In those days, slavery did not seem to be an immediate issue with most people in the Boston area. Massachusetts had outlawed slavery in 1783, and the United States had outlawed the importation of new slaves in 1808. African Americans on the streets of Boston were generally free people. But an event in 1842 focused everyone's attention. In October of that year, George Latimer appeared in Boston. He had escaped slavery in Virginia and believed that under the laws of Massachusetts, he would be a free man. But under the U.S. Constitution in its original form, if you haven't read it, an escaped slave crossing a state line must be returned to his or her owner. So Latimer was recognized on the street and thrown in jail, and a near riot ensued in the city of Boston, and it was not resolved until a group of citizens raised the money to purchase him and set him free. Sarah Shaw was radicalized by that experience. She said afterwards that, quote, "I, for one, do not value the wise laws of the Supreme Court of the United States more than I do my own conscience and the laws of God." Massachusetts, the following year, passed and implemented a Personal Liberty Act, dubbed the Latimer Law, which prevented Massachusetts officials from assisting in the detention of suspected fugitive slaves and banned the use of state facilities to detain such suspects. Voila, a sanctuary state. But the oppressors of those years were much like the oppressors nowadays. The U.S. Congress, right after that, passed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, thinking the Constitution was not enough, fining officials $1,000, and today that'd be about $30,000, for failing to arrest an alleged runaway slave. Law enforcement officials were required to arrest people suspected of being a runaway slave on just a claimant's testimony. The suspected slave could not ask for a jury trial or testify on his or her own behalf. Anyone providing food or shelter could get 6 months imprisonment and another one of those $1,000 fines. Officers who captured a fugitive slave were entitled to a bonus or promotion for their work. Any of that sound familiar? So you can imagine the joy of the radical abolitionists when, in 1854, an explicitly anti-slavery political party arose right here in Wisconsin, the Republicans. Many abolitionists flocked to the Republicans, including Frank and Sarah. Frank was a delegate to the first Republican National Convention and helped nominate John Charles Fremont for president. By then, famed orator George William Curtis was part of the family, having married daughter Anna. He and Frank formed a close relationship and worked hard together for Fremont. They lost, but the Republicans got millions of votes, and they would work again for the ultimate victory of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. After the 1860 election, Sarah and Frank and two of the girls went on an extended vacation in the Bahamas. While they were gone, southern states seceded, and in April 1861, war broke out. Lincoln initially called for 75,000 volunteer soldiers. Rob left at home, left his parents a note, and went off and joined the army. When they got back, well, they had a combination of shock, but also pleasure that Rob had finally turned to public service. The radical abolitionists were delighted with the outbreak of the war, since it offered them the chance to cast the war as a moral crusade to free the slaves. Theirs was a distinctly minority view in the beginning, but through aggressive speaking and publishing by the likes of Frank and Sarah and George, public sentiment began to turn around. Frank took a long view. Assuming that the war would be won, how would the freed slaves be integrated into American society? He wanted to show that they could be responsible, contributing citizens, but he didn't want them to become wage slaves. Remember, he was a student of the socialists. He felt their essential needs would be land and education. And an opportunity arose in the capture by the Union forces of the Port Royal Island off the South Carolina coast in the first year of the war. Thousands of slaves were abandoned by their masters, and Frank and Sarah focused on this to demonstrate how emancipation might work. They set to work in a loose and faction-ridden coalition among the government, representatives, private secular reformers like themselves, and evangelical Christians who sought to spread the word of their free religion. With the government assuming responsibility for land distribution, Frank and Sarah concentrated on education. Using privately contributed funds, the reformers managed to put 34 teachers in place, send 34,000 books and pamphlets, and serve over 3,000 students in the Carolina offshore sea islands while the war went on elsewhere. Another hope among the abolitionists was that the freed slaves, and African Americans generally, could be brought into the Union armed forces. They lobbied relentlessly for this along with general emancipation right from the beginning of the war. In some places, army commanders tried it independently. Former presidential candidate Fremont, now a general commanding the Department of the West, issued an emancipation proclamation in Missouri in the first year of the war and invited the freed slaves to join his army. As soon as Lincoln found out about it, he rescinded the order and he relieved Fremont of his position. But the political pressure began to tell on Lincoln, and by the spring of 1862, he was ready to give in, but he couldn't do it if they weren't winning. Now let's go back to Rob. His regiment saw some very hard fighting in their first year, culminating with the single bloodiest day in American military history, the Battle of Antietam, on September 17, 1862. Rob was now a well-respected, battle-hardened captain. Antietam was the victory that Lincoln was looking for. And in the same month, he published the draft Emancipation Proclamation to be effective on New Year's Day. buried down near the end of the proclamation, if you read it, it's a little paragraph inviting African Americans to be received into the United States Armed Forces. Soon, the War Department specifically invited some states to raise African American regiments. They weren't ready yet for military integration or for black officers. Governor John Andrews of Massachusetts was enthusiastic and began immediately the groundwork to recruit what would become the 54th, you've heard it before, the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Regiment. He cast his eye around for a commanding officer, and it fell on Rob. Andrews gave Frank Shaw a letter to carry to Rob, offering a promotion to colonel and command of the 54th. After some hesitation, Rob accepted, and in February, after the proclamation became effective, returned to training camp in Reedville, Massachusetts, to assume command. Some of you, I'm sure, already know the end of this story, but bear with me while I summarize it for those who don't. On this exact date, May 28th, 1863, the 54th Massachusetts marched out of their training camp and through the streets of Boston to thousands of cheering, mostly white, supporters on their way to the transports. At their head was Rob, that is, Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. His 18-year-old sister, Ellen, standing on the balcony at 44 Beacon Street, thought, quote, "His face was as the face of an angel, and I felt perfectly sure that he would never come back." And she was right. The transports were headed for South Carolina. After a first couple of unsatisfying engagements, their division commander, General Strong, asked the 54th to spearhead an assault on Fort Wagner outside of Charleston. The assault was a disaster. Losses among the 54th were very heavy, including their commanding colonel. This event has been heavily romanticized, and if you want to see the cinematic version, check out the 1989 movie Glory, starring Matthew Broderick as Rob Shaw, and also starring Denzel Washington and Morgan Freeman. Of what can be known of the facts, General Stone discovered that the Confederates would not return Rob's body, specifically because he commanded black troops. Stone wrote to Frank Shaw that he would make every effort to find and return the body, but Frank's response became a very public piece of history. Quote, "We would not have his body removed from where it lies, surrounded by his brave and devoted soldiers." The Shaws were crushed by the death of their son, but resolved that his death and the deaths of others from the 54th would not be in vain. So they began a major campaign in national and European press, admiring both the stalwart African Americans selflessly fighting for the Union and the end of slavery and their privileged white commander who died with them. Poems were written by big names. Correspondence was said to have come in even from Europe, from people whose principal or whose only knowledge of the American Civil War came from the published stories of Rob and the 54th. Certainly public opinion of the black soldiers went up, and perception of the war as a means to end slavery was enhanced. As the war neared its conclusion and more Southern territory was occupied, Frank and Sarah's education initiative was expanded. Ultimately, there were schools in all 11 former Confederate states, 301 of them, and 760 teachers, and teachers' schools were formed to turn out many African-American teachers for them. But that was the high point. I hate to end my talk on a low point, but that's the way life is. With the end of hostilities and the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, Northern concern about the former slaves began to wither, and funding for Frank and Sarah's education initiative fell off rapidly. Even worse, much worse, the new president, Andrew Johnson, took advantage of a congressional recess to issue proclamations, we know what those are, presidential proclamations, pardoning many of the former leaders of the Confederacy and allowing them back into politics. And they filtered into the governments of the southern states. And those states set to work to reduce the status of African Americans back to virtual slavery. The so-called black codes were in place by the end of 1867. Now, it might seem that Frank and Sarah's efforts came to nothing and that they were failures. Slavery was abolished, but it wasn't abolished. But this doesn't, in my estimation, diminish them and their family as studies in the striving to do the right thing, even when it's unpopular and very difficult. And issues of humanity would rise again and again. If you're one of those engaged in the study of Reverend William Barber's new book, The Third Reconstruction, you've been exposed to the idea that justice in our nation has not been a settled thing. It goes through alternating periods of dark days and joyful resurrection. Many varied opportunities continue to be available to all of us today to embody our Unitarian Universalist principles in practice. May it be so.